Get the most important woman in your life a 5-carat certified colorless tennis bracelet for $1,650, set in 14-carat gold. Founded by a family of diamond experts for 3 generations. CleanOrigin.com offers hard-to-beat pricing for lab-grown diamonds. Get 10% off when you use code RADIO10 at CleanOrigin.com or one of our 6 store locations.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer? Whenever I want?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. 94% of Sleep Number smart sleepers report better sleep. And now during our Memorial Day sale, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed plus free home delivery when you add any base. Ends Memorial Day. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
We as humans all have biases, whether we like it or not, especially when it comes to meteorology. You may have heard of confirmation bias, Dunning-Kruger effect, survivor's bias, cognitive dissonance, and more. However, humans aren't the only ones with bias. It has been shown in newly evolving AI as well. How can we nip the glitches in the bud before they potentially get out of hand? Our guest today is Dr. Amy McGovern from the University of Oklahoma, who is working to tackle the problem. Amy, and sometimes I have guests that I know pretty well, so I'll call her Dr. McGovern the first time out, but then I'll likely refer to her as Amy throughout. Amy, thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah,
it was fun.
There's so much that we can talk about when you come on the show, so we wanted to have you back. Remind people again how you became a weather/AI geek.
Well, I've been an AI geek for a very long time because I wanted to make computers smarter, and in particular got into AI because I wanted to make games smarter because they were bad. And the weather half just comes from actually wanting to be an astronaut, I think, because I wanted to be floating in space, and I wanted to do AI for things in space. And as it turns out, I'm doing it for earth science, and that's a lot of fun. Plus, you know, growing up in the Midwest where you experience everything in the weather spectrum, it's just, I like having AI make a difference to the world. And that's what AI can do for weather. It's actually save lives, save property.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you say that, because the third rock from the sun is certainly a planet worthy of study, since we depend on it and there's no plan B planet. Let me give the listeners and viewers, because remember, you can actually watch us now on the Weather Channel streaming channel on your smartphones and smart TVs and so forth. Let me give you a little bit of Amy's background. She's the Lloyd G. and Joyce Austin Presidential Professor in the Schools of Computer Science and Meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. She focuses on machine learning, data mining, data science for the physical sciences, as you just heard, as well as real-world applications with a special interest in high-impact weather. She is an inaugural member of the AMS Culture and Inclusion Cabinet. Thank you for your leadership there, and the editor and editor of Weather and Forecasting. She has a PhD.
Oh, that's an old bio. Because I'm not at Weather.
So she is a past editor of Weather.
Because I'm the editor in chief of the Artificial Intelligence for the Earth Systems, because I started the new journal, and so I'm no longer an editor for
WAF. That is correct. Our research team may have dismissed that, but we can certainly update that in real time, because she's very much a contributor to our field and our community. She has a PhD and master's in computer science from University of Massachusetts Amherst, and a BS in computer science from Carnegie Mellon University with honors, I should mention. So, you know, we have someone here that knows what she's talking about. You know, what I want to start here, because I don't think I talked.
I think that's an old bio, because I would have added one more thing to it, too.
Let us know what else you have to add, because we want our listeners to know everything that you have to offer.
Well, I would have just talked about AI3S and being the director for AI3S.
We want to get to that. That's coming. You stole my thunder. I was coming to that. But yes, that's clearly a function of one of the things that we invited her about today. But before I get to that, tell us about what it's like being sort of someone with your background working in Norman, Oklahoma, which many consider the epicenter for sort of meteorological advancement, knowledge, and research. I mean, what is it like being immersed in that world?
The Weather Center is amazing. Yeah. you know, working with the colleagues, it is a unique building that is absolutely outstanding because we get to work with academic colleagues and government colleagues all in the same building and ask questions of all these different experts. And, you know, even though I've been doing meteorology for 19 years, I didn't start out as a meteorologist. Everybody is really patient when I ask them questions, explain me this. I remember the very first time that I tried to redraw a Hooke echo, I drew it backwards without any understanding that backwards meant anything. And didn't mean anything. And I got a very thorough explanation. Believe me, I won't ever do it again. But, you know, it's amazing. And they've always all respected me as an AI colleague as well. So, you know, I learned the meteorology. They're learning the AI. It's just fabulous. It's a great set of colleagues.
You mentioned this earlier, but I want to kind of lead it in now. You lead the National Science Foundation's AI Institute for Research on Trustworthy AI in Weather, Climate, and Coastal Oceanography at the University of Oklahoma. It's quite a mouthful to say, by the way. Yes, you mentioned, and if you can share the quick way of sort of referring to it, tell the listeners and viewers what the main goal of that institute is and why we need it.
So the short name you asked for is AI2ES with the number 2 in it. We had a name that matched that, but NSF said, we're renaming you. And we said, fine. So what our main goal is that we want to be able to create and understand trust. So there are two halves of that goal. We want to be able to create trustworthy AI, and that trustworthy AI should be able to improve our prediction and understanding of a variety of AI for severe weather and high impact weather, the weather, climate, and coastal oceanography parts. But the other half of that is that we not only want to make trustworthy AI, we want to understand what it means to be trustworthy, right? So you can't just say, I'm going to create trustworthy AI without understanding what it means to be trustworthy. And I want to point out that, you know, we're both trying to improve our predictions, but also improve our understanding. We're trying to improve that foundational science at the same time as understanding, improving predictions.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of linger there on something you said, because actually, even as someone in the field, and it's someone in full disclosure, I serve on one of the advisory committee for Amy's Institute. So I'm very familiar with the Institute. But the word trustworthy, I want to stay there for a moment, because I think the listeners probably hear about AI. It's everywhere now. It's on television commercials. People talk about chat GPT, generative AI. I mean, there are all kinds of AI. It's not just AI. There are sort of various facets of AI. But when you sort of say trustworthy, can you say a little bit more about what you mean by that and why it's important?
So what I mean by it specifically is that people are so... Let me back that definition up. We're looking primarily at professional end users, which might differ in the definition of what I'm going to say for trustworthy versus if I was asking about the general public. So what I mean by trustworthy is that our professional end users are going to use the AI products in times of crisis and times of, you know, high impact weather that they're looking at, that they trust what it's going to do. Not necessarily that it's always going to be right, by the way. I don't think that there is an AI or a weather model, NWP weather model, and none of them are right all the time, right? But they trust, they know what it's going to do. They know that they can trust the output and that it will provide something that they can use in those high stress times. I mean, of course, we want them to use it in non-stress times too. But I mean, to me, the trustworthy part means that when they're in a high impact event and they're trying to deal with these things on a quick basis, they're able to say, okay, I can handle, I know exactly what this is doing. And it might be just another tool in the toolbox, right? But I know what it's doing and I can trust it and use it.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back on the Weather Geek podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with my colleague, Dr. Amy McGovern from the University of Oklahoma. And we're clearing up some biases and misunderstandings and perhaps gaining your trust in understanding what AI is and how it will help in the weather, climate, and water enterprise. And that's what Amy is really a key leader in this space. I want to peel back the curtain for our listeners. This is something that I often do because I value Weather Geeks as a resource for people that are trying to peek into the world of the weather, climate, enterprise. I mean, they listen because they're curious and want to know. Tell us how a institute like this comes about from the National Science Foundation. You and I know how this all works, but why is it that you have this institute? What was the process that led you to acquire it?
That's an excellent question, especially for people outside of academia who aren't used to writing giant proposals. So we were working on this institute before NSF came out with the call, but I'll give the idea that we had was that, and this was in 2020, in 2019, that we were coming up with the idea, is that we really, AI was really ripe for everything we were talking about with weather, that it was sitting on the precipice of being able to make some major changes. And we wanted to really put together a group that could do something, to quote NSF's goal, something greater than the sum of the whole, you know, the individual parts are greater than the sum. When you put them all together, is that whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And we were doing that. We were actually in that process when NSF released their call. And so for the non-academics, NSF puts out calls that are a call for proposals. They say, we want this thing in this area. The year that they put out the call for the AI institutes, we're in the inaugural class of AI institutes. So we're one of the first seven that were funded. There were seven themes. And we looked at those themes and we said, well, which theme do we fit best? Remember, we were already together as a group, which, by the way, also helps in getting funded, right? When you're putting together a brand new group of people who've never worked together for something that's on a large scale, they don't tend to be as successful as a group that had already done a lot of work together. Some of our people were new, but, you know, as a whole, we'd work together. And that theme that came out, we looked at that trustworthy theme and we said, this is exactly what we need. This is what the weather enterprise needs. And so we applied for that theme for the non-academics. That ends up being about 800 pages of proposal. But it's not all 800 pages we had to write before that makes everybody go, oh my gosh, I could never do that. The main proposal is 25 pages. And then there's a lot of supporting documentation.
In there, done
and,
that.
We, those of us who don't academics have done it. And it's, you know, you write a very careful vision and a very careful response to the call, and then a lot of supporting documentation saying all the things you're doing and all the ways in which your team is going to be the team that does this. I think that's something that was different for these larger scale calls versus people who might be used to writing the like regular scale calls on like, I don't know, $500,000 scale. We had to go through a second process. So you write this proposal, you made it to the finalist round, and then you had to actually be interviewed as a team. They called it a reverse site visit. Remember that this was all during 2020, so everything was online. So we did a Zoom reverse site visit with our whole team with NSF. And they've never officially told us. I think there were three teams that made it to finalist. I don't specifically know that for a fact. And they did this site visit. And then afterwards, you know, a couple of weeks later, they told us we were it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they made us ask hard questions on that visit, by the way.
Yeah, I recently, well, maybe about a year ago, participated in a reverse site visit here at the University of Georgia with my colleague, Mandy Joy. Shout out to Mandy Joy and the team at UGA and Georgia Tech that put that proposal together. We didn't get that call 2 weeks later, but we were close, so we'll probably try again. But I thought it was just interesting and useful for people listening to this podcast or watching on the Weather Channel's streaming channel to sort of understand sort of the under the hood process that we go through as scientists.
I think that part of that to say is that you really need to have that team together, right? Yeah. If you're going to tell a successful story, that team needs to have worked together and have a really good understanding of what they can do to make that real synergy. And I use that synergy word, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, that's a buzzword, but we really mean it. You know, we're not just spending, because you only get 5 years of funding and only, right? But that 5 years, you really want to hit the ground running, and you want to do that by being a team that's ready.
Now, I want to pivot back to some of the things you're working on, because I know that you and your students have been involved in something called explainable AI. Mm-hmm. What is that? Explain it to me, please.
So the idea is that a lot of AI is considered to be a black box. That is, you can't really see inside it. You plug in your data, you get an answer out the other end. And the idea of explainable AI is that you can try to peer somewhat in there. I'm not going to say you're going to make it a clear box or a white box. You're going to make it a little gray. But you're going to get some understanding of what's going on inside that AI. And the idea is that that will help somewhat with trust. Some of the end users really want to know what's going on, and particularly want to know if what it's learned is physical. If I give it non-physical data, will it give me a non-physical answer? If I give it physical data, but it's on the outline, you know, it's extreme example, is it going to give me something that's reasonable, or is it going to give me something crazy? So, for example, if I'm giving it, whether people like to think of it, a lot of 2D inputs of maps, or 3D if you're looking at the layers of the, you know, the atmosphere. If I give it that as an input and you say, which parts of this matter the most to the prediction I'm making, you'd like it to highlight pieces of it that are most important and that make sense. It doesn't just randomly pick, I don't know, Seattle matters to the temperature in DC today, right? That would make you go, no.
Yeah. So
that's, you know, I'm not going to say explainable AI, by the way, is super perfect at that. It's giving you ideas at it. So that's another part of that. It's hard.
Right. I mean, this is certainly challenging. And I wanted to kind of move now. I teased the intro to the show by talking about ways that AI has biases as well. And humans have biases. But before we get to that discussion, talk a little bit, because if you're listening to Weather Geeks, there's a pretty good chance that you have at least some familiarity with the fact that much of today's 1 to 10 day weather forecasting is done through numerical weather prediction, in which we have these models that have been constructed based on physics and calculus and equations, governing equations of fluid dynamics and so forth. And they solve these equations, out 1, 2, 3 days based on certain boundary conditions and initial conditions and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about how AI is now either a part of that process, or we had someone, Weather Geeks, talking about how there's verification. I think it was someone from Google. So talk about the ways that you see AI intersecting with the weather forecast process currently, and perhaps how that may evolve.
Sure. I give you two answers because there are two big ways it's going. Right now, a lot of what AI is doing is taking those numerical weather prediction models and either post-processing them to try to remove some of the biases, because we talked about the fact that none of them are ever right all the time. Right. So can you post-process them, and can you remove some of those biases? There are other people who are working on taking pieces of those physics parameterizations, because they're never just the raw physics, right? They're parameterized because we can't do the raw physics because it's just too hard computationally, and replacing those with AI. And that can be done faster than the traditional NWP model. So that's one sort of, I put that all in one bucket. The other bucket that's coming down the path right now that I think has really changed in the last 18 months, since you last had me on the show, this bucket didn't exist last time.
That's why we wanted you back.
Well, and you said you wanted to hear updates. One of the things that's really changed is that people are doing this completely data-driven. So they're learning pure AI models. So they're taking things like ERA5, which is, you know, the most comprehensive data set of reanalysis data on a global scale, and training models just based on those observations. There's no physics involved. That's what's really fascinating. And they're giving you an AI prediction for the next 7 to 10 days out of that. Is that ready to go live? No, not quite yet, but it is actually getting used. I just noticed earlier this week, Pivotal Weather has incorporated ECMWF's model into their predictions. So you can just select as one of the models. And, you know, we have a collaboration with Colorado State University, which is putting a webpage together with a lot of these models, Google's model, NVIDIA's model. They're not being used to forecast like operationally, but they're being used. People are looking at them. People are evaluating them. One of the other things I think is really interesting about that is that you talked a lot about the physics, right? The numerical weather prediction models have the physics in them. They have them parameterized, but they're still physics-based. These don't have any physics in them. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not they're learning the physics. There was a really good talk at AMS this year. I'm being live and my brain is going to completely...
We can tweet it out later once we find it.
Anyway, he was talking about how to do the Gregory Haycombe, thank you. You had to give my brain a second there. From University of Washington, maybe you can cut that pause out.
We like the rawness of the show. I think.
Oh, I'm going to feel bad. Greg's going to think, oh, she forgot my name. It's just been a really long week for me.
Hey, Greg, it's 8:30 in the morning where Amy is, so chalk that one up to a little bit of a brain freeze in the morning. We all have.
Yeah, we do, and it's been a really long week, and I won't explain that on your broadcast. But anyway, he gave a talk. He was evaluating different ways that you could look at the physics of the model and see whether or not they'd actually learn something physical, and it was really cool. And for example, take one of those models and put a warm bubble in it and then see what happens, for example. And I think that's going to lead us down the road to a better understanding whether or not it has learned physics or whether it's done something really crazy. I mean, you asked about this. I think eventually, my prediction eventually is that these pure data-driven models are going to add some physics in, and then they're going to be amazing.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting that there's this notion that AI is learning the physics is the same way that those of us that sat through thermodynamics class or atmospheric physics class, the models are probably sort of saying, oh my gosh, I'm kidding, because those are some of the classes as meteorologists that we take that, you know, those of us that have meteorology degrees, certain classes you just remember well. And so that's certainly one. So kudos to AI that's getting in the game of learning physics, perhaps. But I want to kind of circle back to, what are some of the biases that you are starting to see from an AI perspective in the weather models? What are some of the things that you're noticing?
That's an interesting question. We just had a BAMS paper. I just finished reviewing the proof. So it will be out probably next month's BAMS.
Bulletin of the AMS, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
The one where BAMS is.
So in that, we just categorize the biases that are apparent in AI for earth sciences. So I'll give you our four categories. The first one is systemic and structural biases, which are the biases that exist sort of in the fabric of society. And in the cases that you see in the news, a lot of what you see in the news is racial bias, right? And racial bias doesn't necessarily show up in the weather data, but what you're seeing is other systemic and historical biases, places where there's less sensors, for example, from that systemic and historical biases, places where there's less high quality sensors, things like that. But there's also institutional biases that fit into that. And that could be weather-based institutional biases that aren't necessarily intended to be a bias. So the example we give in our paper is wanting to call a tropical cyclone or a hurricane at daylight, only because the sensors are better at daylight. You know, you can see the visible at daylight. That isn't a bias that's intended to be a bias, but if you're training an AI model that has that bias in it, it might not say that it's a hurricane overnight, even though you have decent, you know, non-visible imagery now. Right. So that's the first category. The second category has those human biases that you talked about at the beginning. You know, a lot of the Dunning-Kruger effect, the confirmation bias, all of those. We picked four of them for the paper, but just because there's the human bias codex is huge. But those human biases can lead us to perhaps not look at data that, you know, miss the fact that there's data that's not being collected, not even collect that data, to choose biased data without realizing it, to try to make sense of data that we don't necessarily shouldn't be doing. So the human biases then could affect the AI model. So there's statistical and physical biases. There's data biases. Our third category is data biases that come from just having raw biases. So there's an example we gave that could be influenced. These are in a circle because they're influenced. So that historical biases could, for example, influence the fact that we've found that there's biases towards better temperature data in more affluent areas, for example.
Right. Oh yeah, we've seen some of that too.
Yeah. But one that's unique to earth sciences, it's different than regular AI biases, is physics-based bias. And that is just based on the laws of physics, you have a bias to your data. So satellites, for example, they can be geostationary, they can be polar orbiting, but you're going to get only a different view of the data based on that. You might not get as frequent data, you might get an angle of that data. It's just different. Radar data, for another example, you know, the earth fault, it's round. You're not going to get that data. So that's something that's unique to earth sciences. And then our final bias category was AI bias. So the models themselves can have biases in them. In that, in particular, brings us back to the discussion we just had, where the AI models don't understand the laws of physics. So they can learn something that they think is giving you a really good prediction, but it might in fact be biased because it might have learned a law of its own physics that isn't right. That's part of where that explainable AI comes in, trying to figure out, what did you learn?
Now, when we come back, I'm going to ask Dr. McGovern about some ethical aspects of AI.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. I'm speaking with Dr. Amy McGovern from the University of Oklahoma. I think they call it OU out there, even though it's
yes.
University of Oklahoma. I've always wondered about that. So if you've got a story, please do tell. But in terms of AI and ethics, your team recently, or somewhat recently, I guess, published a paper, and it was called Why We Need to Focus on the Developing Ethical, Responsible, and Trustworthy AI Approaches for Environmental Sciences. And I've been sort of in my world at UGA, I've been working with some folks in the humanities part of our college that are thinking about ethics and AI and sort of marginalized uses and so forth. And there's some really interesting discussions at the interface of sort of the humanists and our environmental sciences group. So talk to us about what you mean when you think about ethics.
It feeds partly into what we just talked about. That was our newer paper that I just talked about. The one you're referencing is the older one, but they're both important and they tie together. So part of that ethics is making sure that we're trying to develop a model that's as unbiased as possible. Part of it is making sure we had a list in that paper you're talking about of all the ways in which AI can go wrong. We said it's non-comprehensive, right? Because we could think of other ways that they could go wrong. But part of it is making sure, for example, that you're working with the people who are going to be affected by your AI model, that you're co-developing with them, but you're not just swooping in and saying, here's your AI model, here's your solution, because you might be developing something that doesn't actually help and could in fact hinder. One of the big concerns we have with the AI models is that they could exacerbate environmental or climate injustices, that we already know that marginalized communities are getting more affected by climate change, and that if you're not paying attention to the model biases, if you're not working with the people who are being affected by it, you might create something that unintentionally exacerbates bias. And if you say, I'm creating trustworthy AI, and people believe that, and then you made it something that was biased, then you might even do even more harm. That could really be a problem. We want to make sure that what we're doing is actually meeting the needs and being trustworthy and being developed ethically and responsibly.
So what about, and this is coming from folks that I've talked to in the humanities space. There have been concerns because one of the things that AI does is it sort of learns from existing data sets and from different things that are out there in some ways. And there are people that have questioned whether AI is gaining intelligence, if you will, or gaining its knowledge on the backs of other people's published work or other people's data. Any thoughts on that?
I think it certainly is. I mean, I think that's a lot of the concern with ChatGPT is that it's ingesting a lot of papers and then understand, and that it's, you know, putting that back out without necessarily citing it. So it could be giving you data that's caught, you know, taking ideas from other people. I think that's true for coding as well. You know, when you ask it, hey, write me some code to do this, you don't know where that code's coming from unless it's citing it, and the ChatGPT doesn't. One of the newer models does. I think that that's less of a problem for weather in the sense that the weather data obs are sort of belong to everybody if you ingest an ERA 5. You know, I mean, ECMWF gave them out, but you could certainly still be doing biased things, perhaps not as easily in that sense. You can be, you can't be stealing data, but you could imagine other applications for AI there, you know, that we, that, that could cause problems. And also some of that data that's collected, I mean, I know nothing about ERA5's data collection. I think that I'm teaching a class on AI and ethics, and we're actually doing the data module right now. And we're talking a lot about ethical ways to collect geosciences data. So not necessarily ERA5. So take that. This is not a statement about UCMWF, but there are geosciences data you could collect that is unethical that then could get ingested into an AI model. It could be a problem. So we're talking about respecting indigenous data and ways to ethically collect and work with indigenous researchers, for example, right now.
Yeah,
and if you had that data, I mean, ERA5's not doing any of that, but if you had that data online, you could imagine an AI model could just ingest it without understanding the, what it's doing and being respectful of it.
Exactly. Yeah. We've had some conversations with indigenous communities as well about those very things. You mentioned educating, and also you mentioned earlier working with users, corporations, companies, and so forth. I guess the question that I have, and I want to make sure I frame it right, because I'd written this down. Do you think trust will be a large barrier for those in our industry and perhaps in private sector industries that want to utilize the data? Do you think that there are barriers that will sort of halt the sort of transition of use in the sort of private sector or in stakeholder use? Or are you seeing the data flowing without much concern at this point?
For the data or for the AI in general?
For the AI implementations. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is there, you know, I remember a long time ago, there was this sort of crossing the valley of death. We were talking about transitioning research over to operations in some ways. And I guess we're sort of at that second valley in terms of AI. And I'm just wondering if the trust issues and ethics issues that have made it possible that you've encountered situations where people don't want to use it or people said, no thanks.
I'm seeing sort of the opposite. I'm seeing AI rushing ahead right now, which actually could be a problem on the trust issues. It's something I have a concern about. I gave a talk at AMS and mentioned that I'm worried that we're rushing ahead so quickly with the implementation of AI in the private sector, particularly that we're going to do something untrustworthy and it's going to cause the general public to lose trust in what we're doing. And I don't want to see that, right? I mean, part of the reason that NOAA is so slow to adapt new techniques is they want to thoroughly test them to make sure that what they're doing is trustworthy, that they don't want to lose the public's trust. That's really, really important. They're NOAA.
Right.
And I'm concerned that private industry is going whoosh and it's a roller coaster, and I'm worried. So I don't see that necessarily, that valley, and I think we might should.
Well, no, I get your point, because I what I hear you saying is something very similar to sort of the, what I used to call the wild, wild west of weather information and social media, in the sense that you have all kinds of things out there. Hey, we're going to have a snowstorm in 30 days from some incredible, not credible source. So you just have this sort of wild, wild west. And then you have these sort of more trustworthy, sort of slower moving sources that for good reason, you know, our colleagues that, you know, want to make sure they get it right. So what I hear you saying, I think, is that there's sort of this wild, wild west in the sense that, you know, things are exploding and perhaps there need to be some guardrails.
Yes. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
We had a great talk at AMS also, not from me, from Emma Ebert-Uplas, who gave a talk about AI and trying to find a way that we could just come together and evaluate these things rather than just whoosh, they're free.
So we've had, I come, Amy, as you know, I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard talking with Amy McGovern. I come from the world of NASA, and I remember, you know, we would launch these satellites and have these new data sets coming from space. I worked on the Global Precipitation Mission, GPM, and we would have these intercomparison projects. People would develop different algorithms to evaluate and to quantify rainfall globally, and they'd use different approaches, and there'd be these large intercomparison projects. Are you saying that we don't have something similar in the AI space right now?
Not yet. Not on the global AI space. It's being developed. There's discussions of benchmarks. At certain timescales, there's benchmarks. There's WeatherBench. There's WeatherBench 2, for example.
We've talked to WeatherBench on the podcast, sure.
Good. Yeah. So, I mean, that's certainly one of the benchmarks that's out there, but there isn't like a known gold, this is a benchmark that you must pass in order to do, you know, to say that your AI model is got a gold standard. I think that to bring you to probably a place you weren't about to expect me to go, NIST has just got, so NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, they develop a lot of standards. It's what they do, so that you know when you plug your plug into the wall, it's not going to catch fire, right? They just put out an AI Safety Institute consortium, and AI2ES is one of the members of it. And what our goal is to help them develop some standards. I will focus on weather, but you know they've got a whole, they've got 200 members, right? We're going to develop AI standards in general so that AI could have some of those gold standards. Now, I'd like to see us develop them for weather particularly, but I think AI in general just needs some of these standards. You know, it's not going to hallucinate too badly. You know, it's not going to have this much bias. You know, some way of doing that. And that doesn't exist yet.
Did you say hallucinate?
Is that hallucinate.
Okay, so AI can hallucinate. Again, I want to go there. How can AI hallucinate? What do you mean by that?
So generative AI is really kind of a hallucination. It's coming up with, you give it input, but you give it some amount of randomness, and it gives you an output, but that's coming up with that output entirely internally to that black box of its model, right? And that might make physical sense, but it really isn't like it's chugging through physical equations. And so it can give you something that's hallucinatory in that sense. You know, there's some good examples online about like making up faces, right? You train it on a number of millions of human faces, and then you ask it to give you a new face, and it's giving you a new face that doesn't really exist in humanity, but that looks real enough to you. Can you do that exact same thing with weather? Can you give it a whole bunch of hurricanes and then have it hallucinate a hurricane? It probably will come up with a realistic hurricane, but that hurricane's never existed in reality.
So is this a concept? I mean, I've been seeing, and I've even some of our colleagues at the University of Georgia are working with things like deep fakes and those types of things. So we can sort of have a hurricane deep fakes is what you're suggesting.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, interesting. So, you know, I always feel like I could talk to you forever about this, but we're running out of time. Where are you focusing most of your so-called education efforts? I know you mentioned you're teaching a class there at the University of Oklahoma, but are you and your institute engaged in other sort of engagement and outreach efforts, and who are you targeting mostly?
Two halves to that. We've got workforce development. So we're working on that one. We're targeting sort of the existing workforce, trying to train them in AI. We've got tutorial papers. We've got summer schools we've been running. We've got a lot of stuff we've put online. The other half is looking at the younger generation. So we're working with a community college, Del Mar College. They've got an AI occupational skills award, it's called, and that's in place. It's 14 hours. You can take an AI and you can transition it to your job, or you can transition it to the university if you want to transfer there. And then they also work with K-12 outreach. So trying to bring that next generation in. And they're a Hispanic serving, minority serving institution, which really excites us as well, because we all know we need more diversity. We need more diversity in AI. That will help with the bias that we're talking about, getting more good viewpoints in there, but we need diversity in the geosciences in general. And so reaching an audience that we don't typically reach, we're making sure that we are bringing that to a different audience. Del Mar is largely a Hispanic serving institution. They're in very South Texas. If you take the map of Texas, they are at the very bottom of Texas. And we're able to convince people that wouldn't normally have heard about AI for the earth sciences that this would be an amazing career.
Well, again, I always enjoy talking to Amy, so I'm glad you were able to come on the show. Amy, thank you. Oh, before we go, where can people find out more about you on the web or on social media?
Great idea. Great question. I'm not on Twitter at the moment, but you can find us on, so you can just Google my webpage, but for AI2ES, it's AI2ES.org, and you can get more information about us. And then from there, you can find my webpage. I'm just easily findable if you type in Amy McGovern. I am on Threads, and I'm on Blue Sky. And I kept my handle over from Twitter, which is at Prof Amy McGovern. I'm not as super active on there as I was on Twitter, but maybe once one of those settles in, I will.
Yep. Yeah, I'm in both of those spaces as well as still on Twitter/X, whatever it's called, but migrating into many other spaces as well. Amy,
I'm more on LinkedIn, by the way. That would be the place where I'm more active right now.
Right. LinkedIn's a bit more of a professional space if you're not engaged on LinkedIn, and you can find many of us there as well. Amy, thank you so much for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
I'm Dr. Marshall Shepherd from the University of Georgia, and we'll see you next time on Weather Geeks.